welcome to episode 29 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, coming round the mountain. I'm Jerry Shario, and usually, at least our regular listeners will acknowledge that usually right at this point, I do some humorous, satirical, whatever introduction to our main host for these episodes. But I'm going to do that later and edit it in right here. So here's Nick Santa Maria.
And that's the story I wanted to tell. So moving on, I would just like to say that don't mess with me, buddy. Yeah. I know how to edit.
I was going to say half of these that I do are just to get your reaction. I want to see how you respond to them.
I don't know. That seemed like the natural response to someone.
It was very good.
Well, hello there. Hi, everybody listening in on episode 29 already. 29. Yeah. You know, I was at a store yesterday and there was a young lady behind the counter and the price came up $19.29, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I mm-hmm. said to her, I said, do you know what happened in our country in 1929? And she looked at me like, no. I said, did you ever hear of the Great Depression? No. It was a financial disaster for the country and it lasted until World War II. You've heard of World War II. No. I swear to God, this was a 20-something, and I'm sorry, but I just go off about these people. They're just, where did they go to school? Mm-hmm. Who taught them?
Yeah.
Or who didn't teach them, more likely.
Exactly.
Right? But anyway, we are here on episode 29, and it is for Coming Round the Mountain. She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. Do you remember the movie Three Amigos?
Oh, yeah.
I love Three Amigos.
Yes.
But my favorite part is the singing bush, which had me crying with laughter. I fell out of my chair. And that's Randy Newman doing the voice.
Yes.
Oh, my God. It was so funny.
That is, in my opinion, a very underrated movie.
I agree with you. To me, it's a very old-fashioned movie.
Yes.
It's a very old-fashioned comedy, and I think that's why we like it so much. You know, it just harkens back to these carefree days. I sound like Robert Youngson. And by the way, I have to say, and again, this is off the record, I finally watched the movie Patton. I'd never seen it before. The movie's 5 years old, and I've never seen it. Watched it for the first time. Excellent film. You know, I hated the scene with the mules when they had to kill the mules. Horrible. I looked away. I didn't see it. But regardless of that, it was Kevin Brownlow's birthday this past week. And for his birthday, he actually sent me a gift. People don't know this, but in that scene in Patton where he slaps the soldier, mm-hmm. George C. Scott didn't know how to do it properly. So here's some footage of somebody showing George how to slap the soldier. Hold on a second. I'll put this in. And we want to thank Kevin and wish him a happy birthday. Hold on. There it goes. All right. Is this how you do it? No, no. Flatten your hand against the face. Look, listen. Ow, sir, Mr. Abbott, please. I'm an actor. I'm not a stuntman. Quiet. What are you talking about? Get out of here. What do you mean? You mean I have to slap him like this? No, slap him like that. How can we please stop? It cuts off there, but it's interesting to know that Bud was so important to World War II back in the 40s when he was making movies with Lou. But here he was in 1970, just as important to the World War II story. So we want to thank Mr. Brownlow for that.
No, let me cut in here and say, you want to thank Mr. Brownlow. Don't include me in that one. No.
I know it's going to happen. I'm going to hear, oh, that was a terrible George C. Scott. Oh, you know what? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I do want to talk about now where Abbott and Costello were at this point in their careers. But first, I want to say, Jerry, how you doing?
I'm doing well, sir, under various circumstances. You know, we're having vehicle issues at my house, and that's never
a fun thing. What kind of issues?
Vehicle.
Oh, vehicle issue. Oh.
Yes, one is in need of possibly a new transmission. The other one got sideswiped by a bus. Oh, and has been totaled. So, you know.
Wait a minute. That happened recently?
Yeah, that was 3 weeks ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, less than a month ago, yeah.
I actually had my car totaled by a bus.
Ooh.
I thought it was a four-way stop sign. I rammed right into the side of a bus and totaled my car. So how weird is that, that we both went through that?
Yeah.
So to speak.
Well, this one, my wife is a school teacher, at least for another couple of weeks. She has retired.
Oh, good
school
for her.
Where she's been at for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. My car was retired after it hit the bus.
So, yeah, she's not leaving the teaching profession, but she's retiring from this particular job. And so 2 weeks before the end of school, the school's bus sideswiped our pickup truck. It was parked there at the school. So that was a nice little going away present. You know?
I'm so sorry. I mean, I'm laughing, but I'm so sorry.
Yeah. There's
it's such a pain, you know, vehicles.
Yeah.
That's the one thing, you know, Manhattan, I would never live there again. I lived there for a while and I would never do it again. Yeah. But you don't need a car, you know?
Yeah.
You eliminate that. You eliminate the maintenance. You eliminate the insurance. Mm-hmm. And in New York, you eliminate the car usually.
Yeah.
It's usually stolen. So, all right. So here we are then. I'm doing well, by the way. And,
good.
You know, yeah, just moving along, singing a song.
Side by side.
Thank you. But anyway, we're talking about coming around the mountain. And let's see where Abbott and Costello were at this point. Universal was destroying them. Abbott and Costello were supporting Universal, making movie after movie and profit after profit after profit.
Yeah.
And Universal is destroying them. And I'll tell you why. This movie comes out and it's facing a reissue of two of their films, a double feature. Now, you know, it doesn't matter what they are. Universal just kept releasing them. They were getting movies from the 40s at this point alongside these, you know, these new ones. Not only that, MGM is reissuing movies they made there. The independent films they're making are being reissued. You cannot go anywhere without seeing Abbott and Costello playing somewhere. You know, it's like I always say, you could go to your microwave and they would be playing there. So I don't know. It's why would they do that? They knew what they were doing. Yeah. I think to this question, I have to say Universal didn't respect them. I don't think they had their respect. Lou was accused of being temperamental with the front office. I would have been too, were I treated the way Abbott and Costello were treated. They were lowlifes. They were burlesque comics. You didn't hang around with them, you know?
Yeah.
Mostly they hung around with their burlesque friends. There were a few Hollywood people here and there. But I want to read you something. And this is from our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. And Lou is talking about Oscars. And here he goes. Did Abbott and Costello deserve to win an Oscar? Lou was beginning to wonder. In February of 1951, he told the press, "What movies make more money than any other kind? Funny ones, that's what. People don't want to look at sobbers and moaners these days. They want to laugh. It's disgraceful. That's what it is. Comedians are looked down on in Hollywood. Did you know that? People who've won Oscars can't be bothered to speak to us guys who fool around in comedies. Some of them even work their way up from burlesque themselves, but now they're above us. It's kind of humiliating. My kids listen to all those Oscar broadcasts and they keep asking, 'Why don't you and Uncle Bud ever get one, Daddy?' I finally had to sit down and explain to him how it is with comedians in this business. It ain't comfortable, you know, this being looked down on like poor white trash." How about that? And this is a problem. This is something that carries on to this day. It's a subject matter for actors, right? Right, Jerry?
Yep,
it's like, why aren't comedians or comedies considered serious business, you know? It always takes me back to that Shipboard interview with Oliver Hardy. And he asked, "How come we're not seeing those great comedies you made in the past?" And, you know, Ollie was older at this time. And he said, "Because they're difficult to do. People don't realize how hard it is to make a good comedy." And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, just as difficult as writing a powerful drama or whatever, thriller. So, yeah, I understand. I really do. And Lou did some acting in those comedies. You know what I mean? I don't know. I feel sorry for them. But anyway, that's here nor there. We have that frustration. We have them being overexposed. And now, this is another interesting point. Back in the 1940s, Abbott and Costello were setting the trends. People were copying them. Studios were putting out, you know, film after film with fake comedy teams or teams like Laurel and Hardy to try to match the success of Bud and Lou. They seldom matched it, but, you know, they all tried. They were in there trying. Yeah. Now, at this point, Jerry, 1951, they're imitating a popular film source. They're imitating Ma and Pa Kettle. So yeah. I'm not saying they're imitating, you know, Lou's not dressed right. up as Marjorie Maine, but although it might be funny. But
no, he did that in Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap.
That's yeah. right. Come on, ladies. Yeah. That was funny. But it's very strange at this point that I discussed this during Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap, the popularity of the Ma and Pa Kettle films. They matched the Abbott and Costello films in popularity by this time. Yeah. And, you know, that was like the writing on the wall. So what happens? The next movie emulates the popular Ma and Pa Kettle films. So Bud and Lou fell into line, and sure enough, they came up with a winner. In fact, it's better than any of the Ma and Pa Kettle films, which I watched every one of last year. My dear friends Lon and Deborah Davis wrote a great book about the Ma and Pa Kettle films and the whole story and all the backstories. It's just fantastic. But I read the book and then was compelled to watch the movies, and they are really terrific. They're a great yeah. little series, you know? Yep. They're not funny like Abbott and Costello. In fact, in two of them, I'm reminded of Abbott and Costello. There's a scene here in this movie where they're at a fair, and they used it the following year for Ma and Pa Kettle at the fair. And during that movie, there's a Native American guy, probably an Italian, selling this elixir, you know, at the fair. And there's these two guys come up and start doing Watts, Volts, you know, all this like wordplay. And John Grant wrote on this script, believe it or not. And the Native American Italian looks down and says, "What are you, Abbott and Costello?" Which is always so weird to me to hear about that. So, and then in another one, Ma and Pa Kettle do 7 times 13 is 28, but they do it in a different way, like 5 times something is something else.
Yeah.
It's not as funny, but they do it, you know? And again, mm-hmm. John Grant mm-hmm. wrote on one of those films during his off time after Lou dismissed him for not signing his anti-American pledge or his pro-American pledge.
Yeah.
I don't know. It might have even been Lemon Pledge. I don't know. we polished that one off pretty well.
Yes, indeed.
So the movie. The movie is, I approached with trepidation. I wasn't thrilled about going back to this film. I remember it being mildly funny, you know, when it would show up on TV, you know, it'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll watch it again, you know. I have to say, I went back to it last night, and I was wrong. It's a strong comedy. It's actually quite good. And it's actually quite funny. Mm-hmm. I was telling Jerry before we went on the air that I was laughing out loud at several spots. So that really does bode well. And it is an inducement for you to watch it. Give it a chance, because mm-hmm. I really think you'll like it. It's so much fun. And Shakespearean. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, Jerry, but later in the film, it becomes very Shakespearean.
Yes, right? I never made that connection, but yes, you are correct.
Right? These guys knew what they were doing. So we have Charlie Lamont at the helm once again, and he brings it in under budget, under time. That's what he does. That's why Universal loved Charlie Lamont. And we also have our crack writers. They weren't on crack, but they were really good. although at the rate they wrote these things, they might have been on crack. Fred Rinaldo, Robert Lees, and our friend John Grant. And John shows up in this movie. So written by our boys, produced by Howard Christie, the new producer. And they have a new cinematographer. George Robinson took over for, what's his name? Charles Van, I forget his name. And it was their summer release, June 18th, 1951. It's only 77 minutes. The budget, $638,000, and it made $1,550,000. So they more than doubled the budget.
Yep.
And you can thank Charlie Lamont for that. did a wonderful job. So now we have the opening shot is a nightclub. It's the Chez Bleu. It's B-L-E-A-U, Bleu. Like blue cheese or blue cheese dressing or blue just alone. Just nothing to follow. Blah. But that's the name of the club, and that's usually what people say when they get their checks. So that's if they order checks. I don't know if they like wheat or rice. But anyway, we see a picture of Abbott and Costello's co-star in this film. I'm rather glad they didn't get billing with them over the title. But yeah, she does get a special title card saying, you know, introducing Dorothy Shay, the Park Avenue hillbilly. Now, she was at that time riding popularity in very fancy nightclubs, the Copacabana, the Shea Paris in Chicago, you name it. And she was doing her hillbilly shtick. She started out as a, you know, just a regular pop singer. And this kind of happened by accident. She was born in 1921 in Jacksonville, Florida. That makes sense. She was originally Dorothy Sims, began her career as a straight singer, took vocal lessons to actually lose her Southern accent, sang for the USO during World War II, eventually changed her name to Shay so she wouldn't be confused with Hit the Ice's Ginny Sims. Mm. Also, she honored her mentor, Betty Shay, who was a singer. So while performing with Morton Gould and his orchestra, she performed an encore of a song called Uncle Fudd, a hayseed novelty number, and it became popular. So it launched her solo singing career. She signed with Columbia, made a series of hit records. Her biggest was Feudin' and Fightin' in 1947. She joined Spike Jonze's CBS radio show in 1947 as the female vocalist. Same year, she was rated number one in Billboard magazine's best-selling popular albums. So she did very well with this gimmick. The only other time I saw her was on the Jack Benny program from 1951. Mm-hmm. And they did a whole hillbilly theme. So anyway, she stuck to that for a while. Eventually, she did a rockabilly song called Hunky Dory. And then in 1970, she appeared as Widow Krebs in the TV western The Virginian. Then she also showed up as Thelma, the owner of the Dewdrop Inn in the TV series The Waltons. So she was on that for a while. She died of a heart attack at 57 in 1978 in Santa Monica. Upon her death, the writers of The Waltons wrote her character off with the mention that she sold the Dewdrop Inn and moved to California. That was kind of classy.
So,
for those of you who are wondering who this Dorothy Shay is, that's where she comes from. That's her derivation. Now, I have to say, the first song she sang out of the 5,000 she sings in this movie. It's funny. I never noticed this before when I was a kid watching this movie. But when she comes out all dressed up and looking really great and everything, and the band is wearing tuxedos and blah, 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 the minute she starts singing, they switch to country costumes. The band just gets up, and all of a sudden there are these rubes, you know, from Kentucky. Yep. So she sings a song about a woman who gets drunk, and it causes her to wink uncontrollably. She winks, and people think she's flirting, you know, but it only reminded me of the time I went to a sleep deprivation place for nymphomaniacs. And it was there that I actually got 40 winks. So anyway, she sings this winking song. And I have to say, she does a great drunk. She really does.
She does.
Doesn't she? Does. I think she's terrific. Really.
Yep.
I will say this about her. This was her first movie. And I know she went into acting later in life, but she really could have been a popular actress, I think, you know?
Yes. Yes. She had good on-screen presence.
She's a natural.
Good work. Yeah. She could work a scene nicely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Certainly better than Kirby Grant.
Yeah.
You know, who looked like a moron in this movie. But anyway, I want everyone who's watching this, if you're going to rewatch this, during this number, the winking number, I want you to watch the trombonist behind her. He's loving every minute. He's got this big smile on his face, and he's really enjoying it. Maybe a little too much. But anyway, so she finishes her song, the audience claps, and we find out that Bud, who doesn't have his derby yet in this scene, comes later. No. He's Al Stewart, and he is her manager and agent. And he also handles a bunch of very unsuccessful acts. She says later on that he has to keep getting work for her so he could pay back the money she loans him to feed his other clients. That gives you an idea of Bud's agent skills. But he does, he comes out and he starts emceeing. And no one's better at this than Bud. He's just fantastic. Yeah. He's got a spiel, you know, he's got a line. Hey, everybody, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. He's really good. And you see it when he hosts the Colgate Comedy Hour alone when Lou was sick. You see what a congenial host he was. He's really good. So he introduces his one of his acts, the great Wilbert. Not Wilbur, Wilbert with a T. And Lou has one of his greatest entrances, I think.
Oh, yes.
Bud introduces him, and from under the floor, he comes popping up. I mean, he jumps way up high. And then when the floor comes back, he comes down. And it's wonderful. The thing is, it's a stuntman going up, and it's Lou coming down.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to say something about the stuntman.
Okay.
You know, Lou especially. Now, Bud was older, so you expect him not to do his stunts, his own stunts. But Lou really liked, you know, doing falls and running into walls and all that stuff. Universal, you know, just like any other movie studio, said, no, you're not going to. Number one, he was not in the best of health ever. And, you know, why would they risk damaging him for a stupid jump or a fall? So there's a couple in this movie that are just fantastic. At one point, the stuntman does a complete flip from a standing position. It's amazing.
Yes.
Really amazing. So anyway, Lou's a great gift. The reason he's great, Wilbert is great, is because he's an escape artist like Harry Houdini. So Bud asks some people to come up from the audience and chain him up. So what happens? Three gangsters are in the front row. One of them is Jack Crucian, who was nominated for an Oscar for The Apartment. But anyway, these three lugs, come up and they absolutely cover him in chains. Let's see you get out of that one, you know. And there's a box that he has to go in, and he has to close the curtain. And of course, he tries to get in there with the two showgirls, who are the two boredest looking showgirls I've ever seen. They did everything but yawn. So he gets into the box, and Bud is like, he's gonna finish, here he goes. The thing is, Bud put a key to the lock in Lou's mouth so he could, you know, cheat. And that's actually the way Harry Houdini did it. But Bud does this and then, of course, slaps him on the back and Lou swallows the key. So he has to do it himself and it's not working. So what happens is the manager of the club, I forgot to look up this guy's name, but I loved him. He was just great. The angry club manager. So negative about everything. But he sends Dorothy Shay out to do the second of 7,000 songs while Lou is trying to get out. And to be honest with you, this worked beautifully. You know, we're wondering how Lou is going to get out, and they keep, you know, opening the curtain, and there he is with a file in his mouth, and he's trying to get out. And she's singing. It goes back and forth. Did I write down the song she sings in this one? Oh, yeah. Won't Somebody Marry Marianne? I have a cousin, Marianne. I used to sing that to her all the time. That's why she doesn't talk to me. Yeah, won't somebody marry Marianne? The thing about these songs, Dorothy Shay's songs, are number one, they all sound very similar. You know, you could play the same chords and they would be the same songs for the most part. And the other thing is they are all story songs. So my thing was when I was a kid, I know the story. You know, it makes it more difficult to listen to when you know the story already. But they are catchy, and she is a terrific vocalist. So, and she's got that, like Jerry said, she's got that natural performing skill. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what happens? How does Lou get out of this? A mouse. A mouse crawls up his leg, and Lou does some wonderful facial expressions when that happens. And that is actually what gives him the impetus to get out of the chains. He's wiggling so much from the mouse that the chains come off. Unfortunately, the mouse goes after the three gangsters who jump up on the table, lift their pant legs, and start screaming like women. And one, of course, Jack Crucian, takes out his gun. Where is it? I'll blow his brains out. And as usual, Bud and Lou are fired. Oh, by the way, Bud gets in an Easter egg during his introduction. You've heard of the great so-and-so. And then he says, the great Bronson. Milt Bronson was their one of their best friends from Burlesque and always on their movies as dialogue director. And he dubbed Bud's voice in Jack and the Beanstalk and Meet Captain Kidd.
Yeah.
All right. So that's stuff you can thrill your friends with at parties. and then you'll never be invited to another party.
Yep.
Okay. Lou, when he's in trouble, lets out this yell, not unlike in Hit the Ice when they, Weoki, you know, but this one's really weird. I have a feeling they said to Lou, come up with a noise that you yell when you're scared. And, you know, that's how they'll recognize you as a relative of these mountain people. It's so weird, but Dorothy, she recognizes it right away. I failed to mention that her name in this movie is Dorothy McCoy. Now, that sound was her clan's call. That's what she says. That's our clan's call. So Lou must be some kind of a relative. He had a grandpappy who left him a picture that proves that, you know, this was his grandfather, and a squeeze box, a concertina, you know, one of those almost like an accordion, but small, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just pictured Grandpappy, you know, with his overalls and no shoes and a beard down to his belly button, you know, and a straw hat, and Lou next to him, you know, with straw and coming out of his mouth and whittling a stick in Paterson, New Jersey.
It was the west side of Paterson, New Jersey. Yeah.
West Side Story. Officer Costello, we're down on the roof. Get up off your knees. What is that? So here we go. We talked about in Foreign Legion, we talked about how we've got to go to Algeria. And the next scene, they're in Algeria.
Yes.
Like within seconds. In this one, all of a sudden, they're in the hills of Kentucky. They're talking about going to find the family clan, and there they are, trying to make their way through brush, you know, heavy yep. brush. And I have to say, this scene is one of my all-time favorites, and maybe one of my top three Bud Abbott scenes. It is so funny. First, Lou does some wonderful stuff. He's got a hat that his grandfather left him, but it's a skunk hat rather than a raccoon. And it gets mixed up in his suitcase with a real skunk. So you've got a real skunk in the suitcase. And of course, in all old comedies, skunks just smell.
Yes.
They don't squirt you. They don't do that. They just smell.
Yep.
Like Limburger cheese. and that's kind of the reaction Lou gives us. And he has this confrontation with Abbott at this point that we have to make you listen to because it's just hilarious.
You know, I've never been in the country before. Smell like Kentucky bluegrass. If grass smells like this, no wonder it's blue. Oh, Kentucky. Kentucky, where they raise the fastest horses in the world. There must be something in the air that makes those horses run. There's something in this air that would make anybody run. The birthplace of Stephen Foster. His songs will live forever. I'm a coming and I'm a going. Wait a minute. I'm coming, for my head is bending low.
Uh-huh. You smell it?
Oh, I don't smell anything.
Then your head ain't bending low enough.
So as I'm listening to Bud sing, mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, during those musicals they made, which was Jack and the Beanstalk and Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd, both with, you know, extensive musical scores, and Bud has to sing. In fact, there's just one line he has to sing in Jack and the Beanstalk and the other one. And this movie proves that not only could he carry a tune, and I mean roughly, but he carried the tune and sang.
Yep.
And even if he spoke part of it, in Jack and the Beanstalk or, you know, the Captain Kidd, he would have gotten away with it, you know? But Instead, they put Milt Bronson's voice, who sounded like up here at the da-da, and Bud's down here, Charlie Lou, what are you doing? It just doesn't make sense. Who, you know, who was driving? Well, not Bud. He didn't drive. But, no. Yeah, I just found that very interesting because he could have done it. He really could have done it.
Yeah.
Bud was probably very insecure about his singing. But I'm sure, you know, I look at ads from the 20s. I mean, when Lou was just a kid, Bud and his wife Betty were doing musical reviews in burlesque, mm-hmm. you know? So he must have sang. I don't know. Maybe the cigarettes or whatever. I don't know. He probably felt insecure.
Honestly, in this one, when he goes into that moment of singing, I actually expected to hear Milt Bronson's voice coming out of his mouth.
He was actually in Kentucky at the time, yeah. hiding behind a redwood while Bud was singing.
All right.
We're alive with the sound of Abbott. Okay. I wrote here, I have a note, that is the stupidest Klan yell I've ever heard. okay, so wonderful stuff. That was just, I think that was wonderful stuff. And I blame John Grant on that entire
scene. Oh, yeah.
So now they're walking through this. I always found this fascinating because I love cemeteries as a person, as a real person. I love cemeteries as a real person. What the hell am I talking about?
as opposed to your other life as an unreal person.
Yes, I can be unreal. I can be unreal.
Oh, yes, you can.
I lived in Los Angeles. so anyway, this one of my, again, one of my favorite things, I laughed out loud here, in this cemetery, and I love this cemetery because it has wooden effigies of all the people that were killed in the feud that the McCoys were having with the Winfields. So they're walking through the Winfields cemetery with all the dead, you know, people. And of course, Lou has his moments with the getting scared, of course. But there's a point where Bud yells out to whoever's listening, "I'm not a McCoy. I'm Al Stewart." Right. And you hear the echo. "I'm not a McCoy. I'm Al Stewart." Then Lou says, "I'm not a McCoy. I'm a Smith." And the echo says, "You look like a McCoy." The echo had an opinion. I don't know. I just thought that was very funny. And Lou, at one point, when the statue of the dead man is replaced by an actual hillbilly, you know, an actual Winfield, Lou does a quadruple take. He doesn't do a double take or a triple take. He does a quadruple take. And I just want to give him an award. Here you go. Okay. For a quadruple type. Okay. So at this point, we meet the family. We meet the McCoys. And first and foremost is my favorite of the bunch. And that's Ida Moore, Granny McCoy. Yeah. She was born in 1882 on my sister's birthday, March 1st. She was born in Altoona, Kansas. She was the daughter, and I kept her parents' name because the father's name, it just kills me. Mr. and Mrs. Marvelton Moore. Marvelton. That was his first
name.
Marv, I guess they called him, you know?
I would hope so.
Me too. Hey, that's Marvy. Just like the Nutty Professor. Well, that's Marvy, just Marvy. So her first professional work was singing along with silent films. Then she toured England and South Africa, entertaining with a partner. Then she returned to the States, performed in a lot of road companies, especially a play called Street Scene, very famous. Then she, just before she made a screen test for Paramount during those days, her mom became sick. And she did what I'm doing. She went back and took care of her mom, who was in Columbus, Ohio at the time. She ran a restaurant for her mom and acted in amateur productions. So my heart goes out to her. That's a wonderful thing. Then she came back to Hollywood after her mom died, and she worked like crazy. She was in Hold That Baby with the Bowery Boys, and she's a dirty villain in that one. She's great. She did Double Dynamite with Groucho. She did Sorrowful Jones and Lemon Drop Kid with Bob Hope. And possibly my favorite of her appearances is in the Jerry Lewis movie, Rockabye Baby. She plays his, do you remember? She plays his neighbor who has the TV on 24 hours a day and tries every product that's advertised. So she's sitting there eating something and spraying her hair with dye. And, you know, she's got every product. And it's just, it really is fantastic.
Yes, yes.
I'm not a big Jerry fan, but boy, he really utilized her well in that one. So that's our story with Ida Moore, who is just wonderful. She died in 1964. Okay, so we meet her. Let's go down the line. Joe Sawyer is back, hit the ice, and naughty 90s. And he's just as comfortable and looks like he's having just as much fun with the boys. He's one of my favorite of their co-stars, and in case you hadn't noticed. And then, kind of importantly, a young lady by the name of Shay Cogan, C-O-G-A-N, real name Helen J. Coggins. Coggins. I like that. Oh, Coggins, get me a beer, will you please? So, yeah, she was born in 1923 in Hudson, Massachusetts. Massachusetts, as Charo used to say. Matatutet. She started in vaudeville with her two siblings as the Three Coggins. And then she changed her name to Cogan. Shay Cogan. She appeared as one of the singers in a show at the Village Vanguard in New York. And then she was singing at the Copacabana when she was discovered. And she was signed by, I believe it was Lou. I think Lou signed her to a personal contract. And that's why she shows up later, or in the next film, Jack and the Beanstalk, as the ingenue. In this one, she plays a tomboy. In fact, for most of the movie, she's dressed as a boy. They obviously painted freckles on her.
I don't know if it's a new DVD that I've got or what, but I really noticed those freckles this last time I watched it. It had to have taken half an hour to put all those freckles on her.
Never mind that, for connecting the dots at the end of the day. but she I often said when I was, even as a kid, she's too cute to be taken for a boy. You know what I mean? So it kind of works, kind of doesn't work. Then you find out that she's 13 years old. I don't know if you caught that, but it's mentioned along the way. She's just shy of 14. And I'm thinking, boy, oh boy. Thank goodness they didn't do any kissing or anything like that. It was just, you know, crushes and, you know, that kind of stuff. She became a vocalist for, as Jimmy Durante calls him, Vaughan Monroe. Vaughn Monroe, singing on the Camel Caravan radio show. And I'm wondering if that's how Abbott and Costello noticed her, because they were working for Camel as well. And she was hired for Coming Around the Mountain, and then eventually Jack and the Beanstalk, like I said. And she kept singing. She married an associate of Roulette Records at the time. Morris Levy was his name. And she released a succession of pop and novelty records in the mid to late 50s, including Doodle Doodle Doo. Wow.
Oh, yes.
From 1957. That's on everybody's lips. Doodle Doodle Doo. Yeah.
It's usually on the end of my pencil, but yeah.
It's usually on the bottom of my shoe. She was also in the movie, early rock and roll movie, Mr. Rock and Roll, starring Alan Freed, also Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Frankie Lyman, Lionel Hampton, Brooke Benton, and Ferlin Husky.
Wow.
And Shay Cogan. She appeared with Buddy Holly, Little Richard, and others as part of Alan Freed's Great Holiday Rock and Roll Show in New York, 1957. And one of her last records, Mean to Me, reached number 40 in the UK in 1960. A later year, she lived in Modesto, California, which is a beautiful section of California.
Oh, yeah.
And she died in 2009 at the age of 85. I hope she was happy with her work and what she left behind, because she was really good. I really liked her. So she plays, what's it, Cora, I think her name is.
She's
young and just in love with Lou. She sees Lou and she's just in love with him. So you have that whole thing going on. There's another running gag through this movie. Whenever somebody refers to Granny as an old lady, she shoots their pipe. They're always smoking a corncob pipe. And it mostly happens to Glenn Strange as of the Winfield family. Devil Dan. Devil Dan Winfield. What a great name. Yep. But anyway, anytime you say old, you hear and the pipes explode. And it must have been something inside the pipes that made it, you know, like
it had to be
in, like an exploding cigar, I guess.
Yeah. You know?
But it's a real cute running gag. which is my Indian name. Yeah, so more family members as we go down the line here. We also have Robert Easton. Do you remember Robert Easton?
Mm-hmm.
Robert Easton, he's always, I'm touched in the head. I was hit by a mule. A butterfly kicked me in the nose. You know, he always had the same kind of lines in every movie, you know, playing that stupid character. And, yep. You know, I don't know if he resented it down the line or what, but he became eventually Hollywood's top dialectician. He became an expert at dialects. Mm. And I believe it happened quite by accident when he went to do some vocal therapy to lose his country accent, you know, which is weird because that's how he made his living.
Oh, yeah.
He was born in 1930 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was the only son of Mary and John Burke. That was his last name. Moved to Texas at the age of 7 with his mom, a former actress. His parents were divorced. They settled in the new cultural environment of San Antonio. And believe it or not, it's still rather a cultural town. One of my favorite towns in Texas. But anyway, he took notice of the style of speaking in the city, and he became interested in dialects spoken elsewhere in Texas and the surrounding region. He had a stuttering problem throughout his childhood, and this made him very aware, so he could work on it. And it did. It worked. In a 1998 interview with the New York Times, he said, "When you have a big stuttering problem like that, you compensate. I found it easier to do voices other than my own." Can you imagine? That took him out of the thing.
Yeah.
It's like the madness of King George, you know, or the speech, the King's speech.
Yes, King's speech.
King's speech, right. He stuttered. But anyway, he turned into the guy to go to if you had to learn an accent. And I'm talking every major performer went to him at some point.
Wow.
So, you know, incredible. As a kid, believe it or not, he was one of the quiz kids. On radio, toured the country with that as one of the kids. He was on the radio show Gunsmoke as Magnus Proudfoot. he was on Fibber McGee and Amali, Fred Allen, R. Miss Brooks, Suspense. His first on-screen credit was as Robert Easton Burke, and that was for The Red Badge of Courage, that great John Huston film. And let's say he got married once to June Grimstead in March of 1961, moved with his wife to England for a while, for several years. In addition to performing on British radio and television, he began to intensify and systematically organize his study of accents and speech patterns. He traveled around the country recording voices of farmers, cab drivers, shopkeepers, hotel guests, and people who sold little kazoos to midgets. No, I'm kidding. That one I just added. anyway, he learned his stuff and became really, really great at it. So he stuck around for a while. I think he passed away in, how old was he when he passed away? I remember him, you know, when I was a young actor in Los Angeles. He was recommended to me at one point when I needed to work on an accent, but he was too exclusive, too expensive. I don't know. But he passed away in 2005. So he lived a nice long life.
Well, yeah. I mean,
75, right?
I remember, you know, obviously seeing him in some of these older movies. You know, he made an impression, and maybe even on an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yes.
You know, seeing him in the TV. Mm-hmm. And then he shows up in the movie Working Girl.
Mm-hmm. True.
With Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford. It was like, wait a minute, he's still around? My gosh.
Well, when you think about it, he was born in 1930s, which made him 6 years younger than my dad. So, he was around. And he was terrific. He was just, I'm touched in the head. and he showed up in The Bowery Boys, Feud and Fools. And he spoke a lot later on about making this movie and just what an education it was to watch the two of them work, to watch Bud and Lou work. But he also mentioned a cruel joke that Lou played during the filming of this movie. During a scene where, I guess it was a medium shot, where you couldn't see people's feet, there was an actor he was working with, and Lou was a prankster. He didn't realize he was hurting him. He was stepping on his foot while the guy was trying to act. And Robert Easton looked at it and realized that he was really stepping on his instep, and it must have hurt a lot, you know, and it did. So he looked at it as a, you know, that's a side of him he wasn't crazy about, you know, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many pies he got hit with, you know, by Bobby Barber.
yeah.
You never know. Okay, so we also, everything is put out in the open. The family finds out who Lou is. They accept him as one of the family and as the heir to the treasure. And nobody knows where it is but Granny. And she's not talking. She's not talking yet. She wants further proof and, you know, she's going to be careful. So we meet the enemy. We meet the Winfields at this point. And this is where our friend Glenn Strange comes back, you know, not in his Frankenstein makeup. But I'll tell you the truth. I think he's scarier in this movie than he is a monster. He always calls Lou. He gets right in his face and calls him Wilbert. And believe me, that was something we all said at school the next day. We all called each other Wilbert. Teachers must have thought we were more insane than you do. So we meet the family, we meet the other family, and, you know, they're the enemy, and they look at Lou as the enemy. But anyway, the McCoys, Lou's family, wants to christen him. And this is at a big, like a celebration, like a picnic. And there's pies and all this stuff. And Granny puts a pie on the table. And Lou comes over and they say, we want to christen you as a member of the family. Lou makes a joke about, aren't I too big to be christened? You know, like he's a baby. I think Bud says, they do battleships. Why not you? Yeah. So what that means is Lou takes off his hat. He bows over the picnic table. They hit him over the head with one of those jugs. It explodes on his head, and he gets pushed down into the pie, which is right below his face. It's a laugh out loud moment. It's not only is he getting like smashed over the head with this jug, but the pie being right there is it's the icing on the cake, so to speak. So at this point, we also get the 8,000th song that Dorothy Shay, the Park Avenue Billy, sings. And this is called Sagebrush Sadie. Sagebrush Sadie, the Southern Married Lady. They're all the same.
Yes, pretty much. Well,
they really are. But, you know, it's cute. She does a nice job on it. And what I love about this scene is watching Kirby Grant pretend to play the guitar while he's in a full suit and a straw hat. And he looks like a moron. He just looks like a moron. He's looking at her like he's going to eat her for lunch, for one thing. And I'm watching his hand on the frets, and it doesn't move. It's a miracle. It's just a miracle. So, and every song gets to the same conclusion. You know, it's the same rhythm. Then you get to the end. They all end the same way.
Yep.
That false ending. So anyway, the next song comes up rather quickly. This is the 8,130th. And this is maybe my favorite. And it's called You Broke Your Promise. And I'll tell you why it's my favorite. But not only the tune, I really like the tune, but we'll talk about it. Let's hear a little bit of that.
But you broke your promise. Oh, yes, you broke your promise. And that is how you broke my heart.
My darling daughter's still another course. I
wish you had a nickel every time that she was fickle.
There's no mirror on his shelf. He's so mean he hates himself. Nothing left for me to say. Come on, Wilbert, start to play.
So there it is. You broke your promise. Let's face it. Anytime Lou is involved in a musical number, it makes it special. It just, to me, it adds another star, you know, to the rating. And he hasn't done his rhythmic playing since It Ain't Hay. He was doing that during one of the numbers.
That's right.
He's got his two drumsticks and he's playing. He could have been playing for Spike Jonze's orchestra, you know. He's playing the washboard, he's beeping the horn, and his sense of rhythm is just fantastic. He really had drumming talent.
I got to say, in my younger days watching these movies, when I was growing up, the music wasn't always my favorite part, as can be the case with a younger kid. But when this movie came on, I waited for this number. Mm-hmm. Just to watch Lou go into town on the washboard, the snare drum, the wood block, everything he was playing there.
And it's all done with confidence,
Yes.
I doubt he rehearsed all that much. It's Lou.
Yeah.
But he just had a natural sense of rhythm that really worked when he got a couple of drumsticks in his hands. He didn't exploit it, but when he used it, it was always fun to watch. And you need a sense of rhythm to do the kind of comedy he did. I learned some of the tricks he did with his hands and things he would he would juggle with one thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I learned how to do it. But you need a sense of rhythm to be able to do those things. So, yeah, he had that and it was great. Another one of my favorite scenes comes up and it's just so funny. The hot dog scene. He goes to the hot dog vendor. Now, I want to preface this because Lou was a bad boy here. And this is one of Lou's black marks. An actor was actually hired to play the hot dog vendor. And Lou said, no, get rid of them. I want my brother-in-law, Joe Kirk, to play the hot dog guy. And they had to do what Lou said. So anyway, that wasn't very sporting of him. But anyway, Joe is great, as usual. The whole thing about when he puts... He shows him how he puts the mustard in the middle of the hot dog rather than on top of the hot dog because it's so much neater, And Shea Kogan takes the hot dog and bites into it and all the mustard squirts onto Lou's face, right? But the kicker is when Bud comes by and looks at him and Lou looks at him with a face full of mustard and says,
"Now you know why I don't like mustard. Now listen."
It's like, I love when they call back to their routines, Everybody knows mustard goes with the hot dog. Very, very funny. Okay, so then we've got the turkey shoot. And the writers themselves said that this was inspired by Sergeant York, the movie Sergeant York with Gary Cooper. He won an Oscar for that one, in fact. But there was the turkey shoot during that. It was a famous scene. And they decided to spoof it with Abbott and Costello. And that means that we go back to the trope, the pale face with Bob Hope, where Jane Russell is doing all the shooting for him. That kind of happens with Shea Kogan, who is an expert crack shot, who's helping Lou win the contest. Now, this is very interesting. I thought this was really good writing. First of all, who is it? It's Joe Sawyer. Joe Sawyer is supposed to be the person to shoot actual bullets while Lou pretends, right? And Bud gives him a dollar to do it. And he's happy to take the dollar. This is the mountains, right?
Yep.
Got no shoes on. So he gives him the dollar. Then Joe Sawyer goes up to someone else who happens to be Harold Goodwin, our friend Harold Goodwin. We've talked about him in the past. I used to have his makeup box. But anyway, he says, "You want to make 50 cents? Go shoot for Lou," gives him 50 cents. Harold goes to somebody else. "Want to make a quarter?" And it goes all the way down to 5 cents, and it goes back to Shea Kogan. So not only is she there to shoot for him, but there's kind of a storm, and lightning hits the tree as the shot is fired. So they think he's like superhuman. it's amazing. It hits right at the perfect time. So the lightning hits, and Bud comes out and they run away. The Winfields are totally, freaked out. They run away. And Bud runs up complete with his derby on and says, "Well, us McCoys sure got him." And everybody kind of looks at him and he kind of shrinks as the picture fades. And then we have John Grant kind of pops in for a second. And they do the forefathers bit.
"How could my kinfolks ever live in a joint like this?
Probably your forefathers lived here."
"Beg your pardon?"
"I say probably your forefathers lived here before you."
"My forefathers?"
"You sure?"
"I didn't have no forefathers."
"Sure you did.
If I did, only one come home nights."
"Well, I'm stupid."
burlesque 1919. and then they go to the trying to sleep. And you know what I love about this scene? Bud goes to sleep in the big bed, right? And Lou says, no. I have the power now. I'm the person, you know, that can shoot lightning and all this stuff. I'm taking that bed. You take the little one. So Bud gets to sleep alone in this little bed, and he looks disgusted. He wants the big one. But eventually we realize that Lou has to sleep with five other guys. All of them with beards down to their toes and smelling like goats and, you know, all this stuff. And then eventually a pig joins them just before Lou is kicked out of the bed itself. It's fun. It reminds me of the scene in Lost in the Harem where he's trying to sleep in the tent with the guys. I think that's even funnier, though. So anyway, there's all that. And at one point, Lou is walking outside with Bud, and he sees the goats. And he turns to him and says, boy, there's funny-looking dogs here. That was funny. So here they do. Bud realizes that in order to get the money, Lou has to be married. That's what Granny says. That's what she decrees. And Lou wants to marry Dorothy. But but Shea Kogan wants to marry Lou. She's in love with Lou. Bud just wants to get him married, right? And they go through John Grantland again with, suppose you marry a girl 10 years old and you're 40 years old, not unless I come from these mountains. And they go through the whole routine, which is very familiar to all of us. And you know what? I'm thinking that the people, the audience, saw this routine probably the last time, maybe 5 years past, right? They're not going to roughly. They're not going to remember. And that's what they counted on. So anyway, this is where we realize that Shea Kogan is actually 13 years old. Just perfect for marriage in the hills.
Oh, yeah.
As they say. Which, by the way, did we discuss the fact that hillbilly or the depiction of hillbillies is also politically incorrect now?
No, we have not touched on that.
And that's the truth. It's politically incorrect. Just like, you know, any other stereotype. So, you know, this movie does have that little bit of a stigma, but, you know, if you let that go and realize that it's all good fun, you know, who really cares?
I was going to say, the Beverly Hillbillies is still running, you know, all over the country in reruns, so, you know,
and
people can't be too upset about it.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Okay, going back to physical stuff for Lou, there's a moment in this movie that I'm sorry. It's nothing new. It's nothing he hadn't done before. But when he finds out that Lou is going to get married, Joe Sawyer slaps him on the back and sends him into a post holding up, you know, the house. And it's one of the funniest things he'd done in the movie, in the entire movie. It really is hilarious. Yeah. He does a couple of takes in this movie where, first of all, I have to say, there's a movie I did. It was a terrible, terrible low-budget movie. It's on YouTube. I think it's called it's got like three titles. but this one is called The Bikini Beach Race. That'll give you an idea. And there's a fight scene. And I get up and I go to fight the bad guy. And he punches me square in the face. And I do the exact same take Lou does in this movie when he gets hit. He stiffens. His eyes go wide and sort of cross, and he falls backwards. And that's exactly what I did. So he inspired me. And it's one of the funniest scenes in the movie, in my movie. You know?
Nice.
Anyway, so thank you, Lou, for that. So anyway, this is where the movie starts to get a little Shakespearean. and I'm not kidding. It's actually a lot Shakespearean. And our boys, I'm sure our writing boys knew this when they were doing it. There is one moment that I find very uncomfortable. And you know, I'm an animal rights guy. I'm just, I'm for animals more so than people actually. And there's this whole thing where Lou thinks they're going to kill him, but the guys are actually talking about killing a baby pig, a suckling pig. That's what they call them, because the meat is so tender and blah, blah, blah. These are babies. They're killing babies. These are baby suckling pigs. They're still, you know, drinking milk from their mother. I know people don't really, you know, think about it when they're eating it, but I can't help it. It seems barbaric. Anyway, I'll get that out of the way. But anyway, here we go. We find out, since Dorothy does not want to marry Lou, she wants to marry Kirby Grant and his guitar, both of which are ineffectual. So they hear about a love potion, which is being distributed by a witch who practices voodoo, and she lives deep in the woods. And who plays her but our old friend, Margaret Hamilton,
yes,
who played the Wicked Witch of the West, of course, in The Wizard of Oz, and, you know, played many villainous characters and also, you know, lovable characters and stuff. She had that look about her. She had that incredible nose, witch-like nose, and a chin that jutted out. So, you know, they didn't need that much makeup, actually. she plays Aunt Huddy. That's her name, the witch. And she was born Margaret Brainerd Hamilton on December 9th, 1902. So she was 49 here when she was working with the boys. She was born in Cleveland, Ohio, like my mother. She went to Wheelock College. She was born to W.J. Hamilton and Jenny Adams. Those were her parents' names. She did children's theater as a child in Cleveland. She began her real career at the Cleveland Playhouse. She was part of the ensemble. And she studied under Maria Uspenskaya. Do you remember Maria Uspenskaya?
Oh,
she was the gypsy woman and the wolf man. The path you walk will be thorny. Even a man who's pure of heart and says his prayers by night becomes a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the moon is full and bright. Okay. that's Maria Uspenskaya. She never worked with Abbott and Costello. Okay, first major role at the Playhouse was the first witch in Macbeth. How about that?
Uh-huh.
Talk about a Shakespearean thing. But she did things like, you know, The Cherry Orchard and Candide, you know, things like that. She was quite an actress. She starred in a musical act in vaudeville called Heartrending and Humorous Songs of 1840, 1890, and 1929. I'll bet that was good. Then she turned to acting exclusively. Her parents insisted she go to college in Boston, which she did, and she became a kindergarten teacher. How about that? Eventually, she made her screen debut as Helen Hellam in the MGM film Another Language with Helen Hayes and Robert Montgomery. She went on to appear in movies like These Three, Saratoga, You Only Live Once, When's Your Birthday with Joey Brown, Nothing Sacred, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, My Little Chickadee with W.C. Fields and Mae West, Sin of Harold Diddlebach, which is one of my favorite of her performances, with Harold Lloyd in 1947. She was a single mom. She supported herself and her son. She never put herself under contract to any one studio. She insisted on $1,000 a week, which in today's money is $21,900. So whenever she worked, she had a set salary. And it really paid off to look like what she looked like, because it was like Karloff or Lugosi. It was a calling card, you know, it was your calling card.
Yeah.
So she worked late into the 40s, and in the 50s, she started doing television. And The Wizard of Oz, of course, is the thing that she'll always be remembered for. She would tour in theater towards the end, and kids loved going backstage to meet her. She would play the wife, you know, Parthy Hawks in Showboat. She did Aunt Eller in Oklahoma, you know, all the great late in the day female roles. She was also Cora in the Maxwell House commercials. I don't know if you remember that. Right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. She was good friends. She remained good friends with Judy Garland and Ray Bolger throughout her life. And she was just amazing. She passed away of a heart attack in 1985 at the age of 82. Mm-hmm. She was terrific. And this scene where they go to see Margaret Hamilton should be like in the archives. I hate to sound like Joe Franklin, but right, Jerry?
yes. It's marvelous.
Yeah.
In fact, two quick things. First of all, the early 80s, my uncle worked at the Greyhound bus terminal in downtown Boston, and he loved to tell the story that she would come through there occasionally, getting
the bus
to wherever.
Wow.
You know, she'd come into the terminal because she lived in the vicinity, I guess, toward the end of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And he recognized her at one point and, you know, approached her. Thank you. Ba-ba-bum. She was so gracious. And next time she came through, she looked for him because she had a couple of autographed photos for his three kids.
Oh, that is so sweet. You see, the people who played the meanest people on screen were usually the nicest people.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. But yeah, this scene is just so marvelous. You know, my wife, she's becoming more of an Abbott and Costello fan.
I hope so.
Especially through all this. And we had a moment yesterday as I was queuing up the film. She had to leave, but she stopped and went, wait a minute, is that Margaret Hamilton? And she stayed and watched this scene and enjoyed it tremendously.
Oh, it's so funny. It is so funny. And she is so great. I don't know if you remember this, but she appeared on Mr. Rogers' television show.
Yes.
And she showed them how she dressed up as the witch, and she wasn't really a witch. She was a very nice lady and blah, blah, blah. It was a really sweet show.
Yes.
And how nice of Mr. Rogers to invite her on to do this, because it really did affect how children looked at her. You know?
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent stuff.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is,
yes,
and this is the scene they put into the horrible compilation movie, The World of Abbott and Costello in 1965. Mm-hmm. This was really one of the centerpieces of that movie. And it really is one of the funniest scenes they've done. They did. She molded an effigy of Lou and used it to, you know, put a pin in him, and he would, you know, scream in pain. But I love the setup. It was like, look, she's making an effigy. And Lou says, I don't know what letter it starts with, but it's beginning to look like me. Effigy. So anyway, he gets the idea. When her back is turned, he makes one of her. So between the two of them with these hat pins, they're sticking each other in everywhere, you know, on the head and the butt, everywhere. And they're screaming at each other because they're in such pain. It is so funny. Really, folks, if you don't want to watch this movie and you want to just watch one scene, watch this scene. It is absolutely hilarious.
Yes.
And Bud is like, you know, off to the side wincing every time the pin goes in. I think Jackie Leonard during the World of Abbott and Costello made the joke when Bud's going, you know, when he's like blanching at this, he says, yeah, Bud's the only one who doesn't get the point. Oh, God. Anyway. Yeah, that's why that movie was so good. So anyway, they're doing the love potion. They get it. And of course, she gets originally wants 5. She gets 10 out of them. And the scene ends with Lou on her broomstick, which I think is really, really good. He gets on it. There's a windshield with a windshield wiper. And there's actually a ignition switch. And he turns it on and he flies through the door up into the trees where he gets caught. And of course, his face is in the windshield watching the wiper go back and forth. Really nice ending, a really terrific scene. Okay, so this is where it gets ultra Shakespeare. Now, if you know anything about Shakespeare's comedies, you know, they're all about misdirection and, you know, it's all farce, basically. And this becomes farce times 10. The farce is with them. They use the love potion. So first they give it to Dorothy. Dorothy sees Lou and she falls in love with Lou. And that's what Lou wants, right? But then somebody gives it to Shay Cogan, who falls in love with Bud. She wants Bud. Lou takes it and falls in love with Shay, but she wants Bud. Dorothy wants Lou. Lou wants Shay. Bud wants to leave on the next bus. So it's back and forth and this and that. And it's really, really well done. Very funny. You know, not an original trope at all, but actually probably the best I've seen of it.
Yeah.
So it's going back and forth, and it really is really funny. And then during this scene, there's a song that I didn't remember, a song that I don't remember as a kid because they probably cut it for time. You know, because it was a 90-minute time slot for a 77-minute movie. So they had to cut something, and it's the 9,031st song that Dorothy Shay sings in this movie. And it's called Another Notch on Father's Shotgun. And this apparently was a kind of a hit for her. And it's a good song. It really is a good song. And Lou is involved again.
Yep.
And I think I would have remembered it had it been a scene where Lou is involved in a musical number. So this is why I'm saying that I think they cut it, because I would have remembered this. But anyway, he's reacting to, you know, everything she says, and he's so Lou. He's just great. Anyway, it ends with a really big kiss. I think Lou got the biggest kisses in this movie that he ever got. it's really amazing. And then, what was it? Somebody, there's a line I really liked in the movie. Lou says, "Anybody who would kiss me would kiss anybody." It's a great line. Anybody who would kiss me would kiss anybody. Talk about self-deprecating humor. So anyway, Bud's involved in this, which I love, and they're going back and forth. And then the potions start wearing off. And this is where Lou gets hit with the jug again, and he does that fall that I imitated in the Bikini Beach Race. It's very funny. He tops me, believe me. So he says, they're all fighting. The Winfields and the McCoys, they're all yelling at each other and this and that. And Bud's like, what's going on? And he says, I don't know. My in-laws are acting like outlaws. so then eventually, as Devil Dan is you know, trying to kill them, they had found out that the map was in the concertina that Grandpappy left for them. And they have it now, but Devil Dan wants it. So he traces them into a cabin, and he's about to kill them when suddenly a gunshot comes and puts a hole in the love potion jug, and it lands in his mouth. So he becomes in love with Lou Costello. Mm-hmm. That's why Glenn is strange. So
they do go to great lengths of him saying, love you like a brother.
Yes, they do.
They stress that a few times.
yeah, I think. And it makes perfect sense because, you know, why would it change his sexual proclivity? You know what I mean? It would just make him feel affection for someone.
Exactly.
So he's Lou's best friend. Oh, my brother. Oh, y'all. He's not saying Wilbert. they get him to take them to the mine where the map says the treasure is. And there's a mine there with an elevator. And this is where the whole thing wraps up. Instead of a chase in this one, and I have to give them credit, they didn't do a chase for once.
Yep.
But what they did was the Winfields are after them, and they go to the elevator. There's two elevators, right? And they're all measured by weight. They go up and down in consideration of how much weight is on the other side. So it turns out they're going up and down, up and down. And then the McCoys get involved and they get on it. But Bud and Lou decide that they have to make it heavier. Otherwise, they can't go up. So they put all these rocks into the elevator that they're in. I mean, big, huge rocks. And Bud is really struggling. And Lou is like putting little pebbles in. And it's, again, it's the reversal. You know,
yep.
Lou becomes Bud. But anyway, what it backfires on them. And the elevator goes straight up and through the ceiling of what looks like a great collection of gold bars. And they're so excited. And they're putting them into their pockets and down their pants. It turns out that the army comes to get them, and they are in Fort Knox. One of their best endings, I think. Mm-hmm. I love that they're in Fort Knox and they get arrested. And it's a really nice shot. It's a money shot, really. The doors open behind them as they're putting all the gold bars inside, and you see this entire platoon coming towards them. And I had to look twice. I was wondering if it was rear projection, you know, which would have saved them a fortune. But no, it was about 20, 30 soldiers running towards them. And they get arrested and they take them out. And Lou says, wait a minute. And he goes back and he takes the last bar out of his pants and leaves it there. And that's the end of the movie. And I got to tell you, I was thoroughly, pleasantly surprised.
Yep.
I think I watched it last time about 4 years ago when we were doing the book. This was not one of my chapters. So I may have skipped over it. I don't remember. But maybe that's why I didn't remember that song that she sings to Lou. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you that it brought back memories of when I was a child. You have to realize that these movies were in rotation and they showed up every Sunday. And whenever this one would show up, I always went for an average Abbott and Costello movie, right? I'm sorry, it's above average. It's funny. It is funny. Mm-hmm. And they take this trope and they make it their own. And every supporting character is fantastic. The songs, maybe there are two too many. Okay. There's like five or six. I think there maybe they could have cut a couple of numbers. My co-author, Matthew Conium, totally disagrees with me and loves every song, every word in every song, every note. And that's cool. I love that. I love that he does, you know,
yeah.
Not everyone does. But anyway, I do. I enjoy her music, but I think that it was a bit much in this. The boys are fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Bud is great. And as you're watching it, or as I was watching it, I'm realizing why Lou is getting more and more footage. Because Bud really is there to do the crosstalk routines more than anything else. I mean, he's part of the plot and he's pushing Lou, who is really the main focus. But it's when they do their John Grant burlesque stuff, that's when Bud comes alive and you see why he's there. You know what I mean? And not that he's not in this movie. He is. He's back to being Lou's partner in this. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, most of the focus is on Lou as usual. Excellent movie. I gave it 3.5 stars out of 4. And only because it really, really got me laughing. And anything that gets me laughing is precious to me. And this is one of those things. What do you think, Jer?
Well, I was going to say the one thing that struck me this time watching it, thinking back when it was shown in my area on TV every Saturday night, we had an Abbott and Costello movie, and they were in no particular order.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of their earlier films had a lot of music, the Andrews Sisters and who anybody else.
Right.
And so it never really struck me that this one was so heavy in the music from Dorothy Shea until this last viewing, because we've been watching them chronologically.
Right.
And the last 3 or so films really haven't had anything as far as the music is concerned.
Right.
So, yes, I'm with you on this one. You know, I was reading Matthew's chapter in your book, and I agreed with him that I like the songs. She's good. The songs are entertaining, but I'm with you. There's probably at least 2 of them that could have been cut.
Yeah, at least. Because we kind of get it, you know? She's the Park Avenue hillbilly. That's her shtick.
Yeah.
And it works. She's very pretty. She's very talented. I think she's a natural. And she works great with the boys. So, you know, why not? I'm surprised she didn't show up in a Mon Pa Kettle movie.
Ooh, yeah.
You know?
And it's also the first movie in a while that opened with a musical number.
Yes, right at the get-go. That's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think she was a good addition, and she added some life to this movie. But like you say, I think it's a couple of songs too many, and we could have, instead of 77 minutes, it could have been 70 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a terrific movie. If you want to laugh, it really is a lot of fun. And so what are we looking at next week? We are really going off the boards here. I've been looking forward to this one. Mm-hmm. We are going to talk about their next independent film, which happens to be one of only 2 color films they made. And this is Jack and the Beanstalk. Produced by Lou Costello's Exclusive Productions, and which, you know, leads up to Bud's independent film for his Woodley Productions with Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd, which comes next. But this is their big super Cinecolor retelling of Jack and the Beanstalk in Abbott and Costello style. And that'll be fun, huh?
Oh, yeah. And it always tickles me that these studios would come up with these weird names for their color. Warner Brothers was the Super Cinecolor. And, you know, there's, I can't even think of any of the others right now. Maxi Wonder Color or whatever.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
They all had these weird names to compete with Technicolor.
Right. Which was the gold standard.
Oh, yeah.
But the Cinecolor was the inexpensive counterpoint to Technicolor. If you didn't have the money for Technicolor, you used Cinecolor. If you had more money, not enough for Technicolor, but more than Cinecolor, you went to Super Cinecolor.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about this, really. There's a whole story about Cinecolor. It's a whole thing. A lot of movies were made in Cinecolor and Super Cinecolor. All right.
I look forward to that.
Oh, you're the one. All right. Yeah. So I want to wish you, Jerry, a wonderful 2 weeks until we meet again. And I hope everything is going well with your theatrical projects.
Thank you.
And please give my regards to your lovely wife. And I will say good day to all of our wonderful listeners. And please, I'm going to ask again, if you can please subscribe, if you're watching on YouTube, it would really help us sustain. And I'm going to ask at the end of every episode, please, please just press subscribe and like. Okay, there's like and subscribe. And it really, it'll take you half a second to do this. And it'll keep this on the air. Let's put it that way. All right, guys, thank you so much for tuning in again. I love hearing from you. And thank you for all the nice compliments. And, you know, I know Jerry's the more popular of the two of us, but I really, really do appreciate it. So take care. And Jerry, all the best to you.
And to you as well.
Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, I'll see you around the mountain.